listening to the Defenestrate Media Network.
It's Roast with J.M. Bell and Tom. They're your Roastmasters.
That's okay.
No, it's I do have some scotch.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, no, I don't. I'm drinking rye.
What's that like?
I'm drinking a double rye. Oh, it's quite good. It's a little smoky. It is. I don't know in the movies how those cowboys ever drank it straight. I honestly have no idea because I can't. I mix it with ginger ale, and it's quite tasty. We have a distillery out here that makes mainly rye. It's called Old West Distillery in Park City, Utah. And they do that. They make a vodka that is, I'm not a vodka fan. Overindulging in my teens took that away from me. Much like tequila, which was overindulging in my early 20s, made that go away forever. But these guys, they make a vodka, an oatmeal vodka, that is not... They basically... God. Now, keep in mind, I have no idea how the fuck to make vodka. So most of these words I'm trying to remember from a night when I was drinking. That would be the night that I went to the party celebrating the 2016 Best of Utah, of which I was one. The distillery was up on the third floor. We did it at the planetarium, and they were talking about their vodka, and I ended up trying it, and it was one of the best things I've ever supped. And they just do it, the distilling part, like once as opposed to 30 times or whatever. I don't know, but it didn't taste like rubbing alcohol, and it was quite delicious.
Jesus.
And the problem is because Utah's liquor is state controlled, I have a hard time finding it, and when I do find it, it's usually way too damn expensive. Regardless, they have my favorite thing they make is a thing called Campfire, which is a mix of scotch and rye and bourbon, and it is just smoky wonderful. It is the best shit ever, and it is so damn expensive I don't buy it very often. So
shit.
Hey, the easiest way to do it is to have my wife try it. And if she likes it, then it tends to come home with her from the liquor store, as opposed to, you know, when it's usually just wine for her. She went to Italy, see, and they did some wine classes, and she went before from not drinking much wine to, holy shit, not only can I have it, I know how to buy the good stuff even when it's cheap.
Poor Lisa has migraines whenever she indulges.
Aww.
So we have to, fortunately in this state now, we have the marijuanas. So
yay, the marijuanas. Yeah, maybe here. I doubt it. I should probably move. But no, I don't imbibe very often in libations. Mm-hmm. Tonight, Bren got home from work, needed a drink, and you know, you're going to have one? No. You know, I got to go record and I want to take a painkiller later. And instead I was just like, fuck it. I need something tasty. By the time I'm done, with the recording and editing, I will be fine. So today for myself, sir, continuing on flexing my history masters that I never, ever use in any other circumstance. I do have a couple of things. And again, I hope that, even better than last week, you see that these tie into a central theme that I will reveal at the end of my lecture. Now, the first is Elvis Presley. And
Elvis. The man. Okay.
And
All right.
I was reminded of Elvis, earlier. Today, actually. So this one's just sort of a bonus add-on. But I was listening to the Nerdist podcast with Christopher Hardwick, and he was talking to Cassandra Peterson, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Oh, my God. She's wonderful.
Oh, I think so, too. And if you haven't caught that podcast, go pick it up. It's from Halloween last year. And she talked about when she was a showgirl in Vegas, which, by the way,
no surprise.
Well, I really am sad that I missed it, because the only real pictures of her naked that exist in the world, you know, are from one pretty poorly shot pictorial she did. And while they are amazing, to see her dancing, but she went on a date with Elvis, and Elvis was a perfect gentleman. He was very nice to her, and he said, whatever you do, get the fuck out of Vegas. You know, go to California, do something else. Just do not end up in Vegas, or you'll be a showgirl the rest of your life. So she left and went to Paris, and then went from Paris to Italy, and then went from Italy to L.A. And other things happened, and boom, she's Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Mm.
And as a third aside, the most interesting part of that is that because she was doing that horror movie show on a local station that would not give her a raise before syndication, she basically negotiated all the rights to the character over a course of contract negotiations until she owned it outright and could do whatever the hell she want with it. So when that, and this ties in because we're going to talk about Nixon in a minute, when RKO got caught illegally funneling money to the Nixon campaign, and went under, had she not owned the rights to that character, she would have lost them in the bankruptcy of that local station.
Jesus.
Instead,
God.
It turned into a lifetime career for her that she actually quite likes. And as an aside, same thing kind of happened with Pee-wee Herman with Paul Rubens. He owns, that's why he keeps doing Pee-wee. He owns it 100%. And not a lot of people that do character work like that do. So Elvis was inducted into the United States Army in 1958, on March 24th, the day that this drops, in 1958. Now, he was eligible for the draft in 1953 when we were still fighting in Korea.
Yes.
January 8th. But he was still in high school. That's my favorite part. He registered for Selective Service, got drafted, and he's like, I'm still in high school, pretty mama. And they're like, oh, okay. You got a student deferment to finish high school. That's important. And then 4 years later, his number came back around again. And he got another deferment for that one because he was in the middle of filming his third movie, King Creole. And then as soon as that obligation was fulfilled, he enlisted. Enlisted. March 24th, 1958, Elvis Presley was finally inducted. Starting his day as the king of rock and roll, but ending it as a lowly private in the United States Army. Colonel Tom Parker made sure there was a photographer, because you don't send Elvis to the Army without somebody taking a picture, you know, because he wasn't Reagan, there were no monkeys. So he went through that. He got through boot camp, and then they shipped him off to Germany. Germany, sir. Right?
Oof-ta.
And it was in Germany that Elvis met Persola.
Really?
Yep. She was 14 years old.
That's right.
Yep.
Get permission.
So in
hello,
the
little girl.
Hello there. Hello there, Rainbow.
Can I shake a hand?
There you go. And so in the spring of 1960, Elvis came back to America. And it's the thing that the article that I was reading says is that there was a very distinct line between Elvis pre-Army and Elvis post. In the early ones, songs like That's All Right, Mama and Jailhouse Rock. And ahead of that were songs like Aloha and Pocket Full of Rainbows.
Very Hawaii.
As well as movies like Harum Scarum and Clam Bake. So it was post the Army that he met Elvira and gave her what she said is the best advice anyone has ever given her ever. But the reason to go listen to that podcast over at Nerdist.com is when you find out who she lost her virginity to. It's fucking amazing. So there's Elvis. Elvis joins the Army, right? Now,
yes.
We move forward to into the 1960s, right? And we look at the first teach-in by professors at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. 200 faculty members participated by holding special anti-war seminars. Regular classes were canceled. Rallies and speeches dominated for over 12 hours, longer than a school day. And then on March 26th, there was a teach-in at Columbia University in New York City. Right? It was a new form of protest that, you know, hand-in-hand with sit-ins and other being in the way, not doing what you're supposed to do. But that was 1965, right? And in 1965, the while we already had a presence of United States Army Special Forces, and we already had what I believe at the time was the third largest Air Force base, United States Air Force base in the world being built.
In the Philippines?
No, in
Germany?
In Vietnam.
Oh my, that's right.
Yeah, the first, the biggest one is still, I believe, Rammstein in Germany.
Yeah.
So.
Rammstein, not to be confused with the band.
Right. And so we were there. I mean, we were there. You had Green Berets running around with the Montagnards. You know, you people with the Viet Minh. We were there. However, it was at 65 that the 9th Expeditionary Brigade of the United States Marine Corps stormed the beach at Red Beach 1 to be welcomed by locals with flower necklaces, not leis because it wasn't Hawaii and they aren't Polynesian, but flower necklaces and a choir from a girls' school singing songs. And the general that was on the ground with the troops coming off the boats, there was a lot of pictures of him taken, and not in one was he smiling. Asked later why he wasn't smiling, he said, "While this may have been a happy occasion, a lot of these kids are going to die. And I don't want to picture me smiling on the first day of what could be the last country they're ever going to be in." An amazing, you know, an amazing bit of being able to foretell what's coming, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now,
present.
So now we have Vietnam, right? And in 1975, on March 24th, okay, this is 10 years after the first organized sit-in, the North Vietnamese Ho Chi Minh campaign began. Now, in 1973, there was a peace accord that was put together in Paris and a total ceasefire, but the fighting had obviously continued in South Vietnam between South Vietnamese forces, you know, and the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese regulars in South Vietnam. And in December of 1974, the North Vietnamese launched this insane attack against lightly defended province of Pak Long, down north of Saigon, near Cambodia. And they overran the provincial capital at Phoc Binh in January 6th of 75. Now, Nixon, see, I told you we'd come back to Nixon, had repeatedly promised Nguyen Vat Thieu, and I'm saying that wrong, and I apologize, but I don't remember. But the president of Vietnam, that the United States would, of course, come to the aid of South Vietnamese if the North Vietnamese committed a major violation of the peace accords, a major violation, right?
Exactly.
So the problem is that from 73 into 75, the huge drawdown of American forces in Vietnam had already begun. There were very few people left. And by the time the Ho Chi Minh campaign started on March 24th of 75, Nixon had already resigned, and Gerald Ford was absolutely unable to convince Congress to make good on Nixon's promises to Saigon. Keeping in mind that the war in Vietnam, while not Nixon's fault, was at its bloodiest and most illegal during Nixon's presidency. And so even though he had made a promise, the United States Congress went, no, we're done.
Yeah, that's right. They say they bailed. They just say, no, we've done it. We're finished.
Right. So this was called Campaign 275, March 1975, to take the capital of Ban My Thot in the Central Highlands. South Vietnamese didn't fight very well. They were probably just fed to fuck up because we'd already basically left. And that began the mass exodus that ends with the pictures, not only of people trying to get on helicopters on the roof of the embassy, but the United States Navy shoving helicopters off the flight decks of aircraft carriers to land more helicopters and take in more people. because at that particular time, we were still doing our best, no matter how shitty it was, to take care of those who had worked with us and fought with us during that insane war of, you know, 10 years officially and almost 20 years since we went in when the French got kicked out after Dien Bien Phu, right?
Right.
So one of the things that I skipped so that we could talk about Elvis was Truman signing off on Palestinian aid in 1949. Because he promised to do it, even though he had a lot of you know, folks that were after him because they just made new Israel. Why the hell would we help the people that we just kicked out? Later, it would seem that we, because this is how we do it, stopped helping. And that's when bad shit happens. So this all ties to my central theme of the president of the United States. Currently, the narcissistic Cheeto himself, while he was on the campaign trail and talking about health care. So we're talking about health care. It's like, I could sum this up because I'm running up on time. But his thing, the way that he promised it was everyone would get it. We'll make sure that it works. We'll make sure that it's better. Now, right. I don't like the guy and I don't believe him because I know he doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. And when he pops up a little bit after those promises and says, who knew that healthcare was that hard? You knew that anything he said was just the same kind of bullshit as everything else that he said. And so we've got the repeal coming. And as of our recording this, they were supposed to vote this bill today. They had a 21 vote gap of wiggle room, but they had 27 Republicans saying, I'm not voting for this for whatever reason. Whether good or bad, and I'm going to go ahead and say bad, because it probably didn't kill enough people. But a CBO revision shows that over the course of the next 10 years, over 50 plus million people will be thrown off their health care. And at the very least, 47,000 plus will die specifically because of the consequences of this bill. Now, if we had a president that was a man of his word and did his best to live up to things that he said would happen, Obama, fuck, even Bush to a certain point. I mean, you want to break down the war criminal George W. Bush's stuff. For all the shit that he did, that dude said he was going to send money to help Africa, and he did. And he did it, and he did it, and he did it. And it was fucking awesome. It was one of the few things one of the very few things with that guy that I was like, you know what? That's stand up shit, because he fought for it and he had to. Every time else you walked in and talked about Iraq, utter bullshit. And everybody just jumped on the fucking patriotism bandwagon. And he's like, oh, and I need some money to fight AIDS in Africa and other African diseases. And they're like, fuck you. He's like, you know, you want me to blow up your place too? Maybe you have weapons of mass destruction. I'm guessing. That's paraphrasing. That's probably what he said. So earlier today, as we record this, so yesterday, as we drop this, and who the fuck knows when you listen to it, you have the Trump administration, including Trump and Pence, who are both supporting this bill that goes in direct opposition to statements that the president made when he promised and chilled people out. Now, unlike when President Obama got caught saying something stupid like, you'll be able to keep your doctor. Well, sure you can, if your doctor takes your new insurance. It wasn't Obamacare that bumped him. It was you changing insurance plans to get cheaper insurance and your doctor saying no. Now, I have teenagers that are a little fucked up because I'm their dad and we're trying to find psychiatric help for them. And it's hard because shrinks here don't take our insurance unless for some reason they are Jesus-based shrinks. If they find their mental health in Christ our Lord, praise his name, we finally found one that took the kids, yada yada yada. But with this, we come down to nothing but just completely pointable, trackable, provable lies, bullshit, and ignorance from the mouth of the mighty Cheeto. Now, to sum up, because this ended different than I thought it was going to, which is why I built this up all week to get here. Republicans canceled the vote today because they don't have the votes to pass it. And the reason they don't have the votes to pass it is because you have those. No, don't do that. because all they have to swing is 8 of the 27.
Yes, and they'll get it.
And those 8 are most likely the holdouts, the libertarians, that are like, you know what? Once upon a time in my life, I got fucked. Now it's everybody else's turn.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to folks like us that are like, once upon a time in my life, constantly, still to this day, I'm getting fucked. And I don't want that to happen to other people. Which I believe marks the difference between a lefty progressive liberal and anybody on the right, no matter how fucking compassionate their conservatism. Is we're like, it's happened to me. I don't want it to happen to anybody else. And they're like, it may or may not have happened to me, and I don't give a fuck because I obviously got through it, so fuck you. So in all of these cases that I laid out, there were obligations that were made or promises that were made and obligations that either were or were not fulfilled. So of the group, the better Americans, in my humble opinion, are Elvis Presley and the professors from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor in 1965, who said they were going to do a thing and did a thing. And then you have Trump, who says he's going to do a thing and doesn't do a thing. And you have Nixon, who says he's going to do a thing and then can't because he quit because he was a lion sack of shit. And the Congress wouldn't set up for him either. And that's what we're going through now. Things these fuckers say are not true and never have been true and never will be true unless they're talking about how big the tax breaks are for large donors. And so
for large donors.
Yeah.
Only. And for corporations. Only. Nobody else.
So as I roast this week, sir, I roast the right from the moderate conservatives with compassion, horseshit, all the way to those libertarians, because white privilege, honest to God, is without a doubt the only fucking religion that could possibly spawn a libertarian party in the United States of America, where we are based on hope, support, and community. And they're like, nah, fuck it. As long as I get mine, nobody else gets theirs. So that is where I will rest my case today. 2 minutes over time, I believe. Maybe three minutes over time. I should have left the Truman stuff out. But
nah, not at all. That's great. Truman. That's fine.
I do.
We will leave that at that.
All right. All right. So let's take a quick break. And then we come back and it is your turn, sir, to edify me.
That's fine.
Awesome.
Let's do it.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. No more fucking ABBA.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Hey folks, Jeff here.
And JC here.
Oh, and Taylor.
I want to talk to you about Patreon. Patreon is how, for the most part, we are paying the bills around here.
Come on, help us pay some bills.
It's important. These shows cost money to both make and distribute, and we don't ask for money very often. And what we're asking for here is you, as a listener, pitching in $5, $10 a month, you know, over the course of the year to help us grow and get bigger. We need it now. More than ever.
But look, you're not just throwing us money. We're going to give you something really unique for your money. Normally, everything you get from us is free. You get a free download of our podcast, The Left Show, the world's greatest podcast, comic book podcast, and of course...
The truck stop visits.
Yeah, the truck stop visits and Geek Therapist. And instead, we're going to give you exclusive content, stuff that we record separately that is then put out for only you to listen to.
Yeah. And I don't have dollar restrictions on that stuff. You pitch in $5 a month, you pitch in $25 a month. That's it. There are goals there. If you do throw in a little bit extra, we send you presents as soon as I can find them.
Yeah.
And for those of you that are waiting for presents, I just need to find the boxes. Don't worry about it. But no, with Geek Therapist, the world's greatest comic book podcast, and of course this, The Left Show, and our exclusive content, you get more as a Patreon member of our family than you do anywhere else. So go to the website for your favorite of the Defend Media families, whether that be theleftshow.com, worldsgreatestpodcast.com, or geektherapist.com. Click on the Patreon button, become a part of the family, and start getting the cool shit nobody else is getting.
You know you want it. You know you do.
Just do it.
There are 10 jillion podcasts in this crazy world, but there is only one that serves a fresh pot of, hi, how do you do? I'm Tom, your host of the Coffee Cast. My mission is to make it as compelling a listen as you'll find it. I'll talk about all kinds of subjects. Sometimes I'll have guests. Good stories, because people listen to what interests them. And sometimes it's the Coffee Cast. So if you're listening as you're texting the seventh draft of a resignation message to that soon-to-be former psychopathic boss, gift shopping rotary phones for your great-great aunt, or skydiving for the first time without a parachute, whoops, welcome to the Coffee Cast. Remember, you can download a fresh Coffee Cast podcast anytime at Stitcher and iTunes, and now on demand on the Progressive Voices app and ProgressiveVoices.com. So until the next pod gets brewed, I'll do my best to keep it fresh. The Coffee Cast podcast. It's Roast with Jeff and Tom. Here are your Roastmasters. Okay, Jeff. So
that's me.
That's you. And I think one thing we're talking about, what I was hearing from you, we're talking about promises, intent. I also think about words. And
words have meaning, Tom.
They have every intent that you're supposed to keep. If somebody says something, if somebody tells you who they are, believe them, because that is who they are. So whenever Mr. Orange Cheeto opened his mouth a year and a half ago, he told you exactly the kind of person that he was. So when people believed his every word, a lot more people are coming around to the conclusion that those words didn't mean anything.
What?
So I go back to a writer who was born around the time that my dad was. He lived in another borough. My dad was from the Bronx. This guy was from Queens. Okay, really different sensibilities. Same town, New York City, and died, you know, not too terribly, you know, just about a week ago, and was about roughly the same age as my father, as I've said. But what made this guy different was he thought with his feet. His name is Jimmy Breslin. And he's most famous. There are two things that I think he's most famous for. He's very much a blue-collar writer, blue-collar columnist. He was in a lot of the New York papers. At the time, there was a New York Herald Tribune that was there. He was in the Daily News, which my dad would pick up, like, all the time. Newsday, which is the Long Island newspaper. And the two things that he was most noted for was he wrote a column the day of Kennedy's burial. And while everybody else was shell-shocked at the time that everything was as crazy and fucked up and confused as it was, Lee Harvey Oswald, his assassin, just been shot, Breslin decided to write about the guy who dug the grave for Kennedy. And that was just so perfect, because it was just an entire, no one had thought about that.
That's beautiful.
Even any idea whatsoever. So when we talk about words, Jeff. We also talk about where we were in our last trauma. What were we talking about? I think I'm talking about Bush and Cheney and the Iraq War. And as we were all experiencing the post-traumatic stress or whatever of 9/11, that's a whole other story. Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, all of the others of that era, that time, had wanted to reinvade Iraq. They wanted to invade Iraq and just knock off the dude who tried to kill George Bush's dad, George H.W. Bush.
If we're doing the eye for an eye bullshit, shouldn't they, you know, try and fail to kill Saddam? I mean, you want to keep a balance in the universe. It seems to me that if he fucked up his shot, oh, never mind. Yeah, carry on.
Yeah, we know what happened. And it was more like, for us, it was like, what the fuck is going on? Why is this going? And they just, it was like the train took off. You could just, I'm not going to go over through the timeline of everything, but we get the idea of what happened. There was a piece that Jimmy Breslin had written in Newsday about 2 weeks after the war had started. And it was, to me, it hit me really, really hard because it in words told about the complicity and the guilt of the people who are responsible for this. It's a fantastic piece. And it's pretty hard to find. I think you have to look around pretty hard to find it. I believe it might be in the Newsday archives. You know, I found it in the Irish Times, of all places.
Nice.
Goes like this. It's that Bush, Rumsfeld, Powell, and Blair will never be able to wash the blood off their hands. And it goes like this. Just so fantastically written. The least blood, a small squirt, when removing a needle, 2 drops, that's all. No more than 2 drops. And suddenly, it is everywhere. It remains, after all. Wipe and it returns. Look about, and it is in 2 and 3 places. Wipe those places, and the blood does not go away. 2 drops appear as a needle comes out, and then it is endless. Blood from the body of a baby bombed to death in Baghdad, blood by the pint running on to the street as fast as a swift river, has magic in its pure infant cells. Of course, you cannot scrub the street clean because the blood from the baby already has covered the street and is in the air. Blood from a bombed baby in Baghdad goes over the wide choking sands and it crosses mountains and then great landmasses and then suddenly over a channel. It is in Westminster in London and people look at the sidewalk and wonder where these large blood spots come from. And the officer on duty in front of 10 Downing Street looks at the door handle and worries, how did this get here without me seeing this and having it cleaned? He has a servant rush to the door with cloth and polish, and he wipes the blood and polishes the door handles and then walks off. And the guard happens to glance at the door handle, and the blood is back, smeared bright new red over the polished handle. The baby's blood is off to rush over the ocean, a strange red cloud poised to rain, and it floats over the green of the Washington parks, and it goes down a sloping street to the State Department, where a man opens a car door for Colin Powell, and he suddenly notices blood on the door handle, and he quickly unfurls a handkerchief, and he wipes the handle, and Powell gets in, and the car goes off, and the man who held the door is left in the driveway, and he sees that the red is still on Powell's door handle. When he leaves the car, Powell does not notice the door handle. As he touches it himself, the blood-red cloud goes over to the river, to the Pentagon, and suddenly it pours on the car. It takes Rumsfeld to an appearance, and this time, the blood is left on the door handles of both sides. A sergeant wipes. The blood is there when Rumsfeld gets home. The red cloud comes, then, down on the White House lawn, and it does more than sprinkle. It splashes on the helicopter of the president, and he strolls out with his wife, his dog, and his chesty walk, and slight smirk, and the wife at his side is smiling, for it is the end of the week, and we are good, decent, Christian people. God bless us, and God bless everybody. And as they are about to get into the helicopter, an Air Force officer rushes up in alarm and says, please, just give us a moment.
And he has three people scrubbing so quickly to clean the blood from the helicopter. And then Bush and his wife get aboard and they fly off to Camp David for where else would you go on a weekend? And as they have neglected to have two men hanging out of the windows and inspecting the sides of the craft in midair, nobody can see the blood back on the helicopter. As they get off at Camp David, Bush's hand brushes against baby blood on the plane, as does his wife. At this hour in London, Blair arrives, or rather arises in the middle of the night, in the middle of his long night, and goes to the bathroom to try to wash the blood off. He couldn't do it before he went to bed. In Washington, Rumsfeld stares at the red splotches on both of his hands, and Colin Powell calls out that there must be something wrong with the soap because it does not get the blood off his hands. At Camp David, Bush notices blood on his right hand and then goes to the bathroom to wash it off, and he holds his hands under the water and he rubs them with a bar of soap and then puts them under the water and he takes them out and he holds them out to dry it with a towel. He glances at his hands and he sees the blood of the dead baby is bright on his fingers. He mutters and washes the hands again. He will do it again, again this year. And again next year and throughout all the years, because the blood remains forever on the hands. And that's former Newsday columnist Jimmy Breslin, who passed away last week. And that was the piece that he had written shortly after the war had begun. And to me, that tells the story entirely about complicity when people are in power. People like Cheney, Rumsfeld, Trump, they have the power of life and death, and especially in Trump's case, holds no responsibility whatsoever. Somebody like them should never be in power, but their actions and what they do, people die. And to me, I may wind up short, but to me, that was just a very powerful, important piece.
That's heavy shit, man. Make no mistake. No, Jimmy Breslin is and has been. I mean, he's that dude has written some seriously heavy stuff from an angle that, you know, not to jump on this tired cliche horse, but you know, will we ever see his like again?
I don't know.
They hand out Edward R. Murrow Awards like they mean something now, and they very rarely do. Sometimes they do. I know a couple of guys that have won them that absolutely deserve them, but for the most part, when you do the best featurette about how adorable kittens are, and you win journalism awards for it, it is a violation of the memory of men like Breslin. And the work that they've done of, frankly, you know, Woodward and Bernstein from time to time, you know, make no mistake. Bob Woodward got a little too close to the Bush administration for a while. It was creepy and it was weird and it made me very uncomfortable. And he's backpedaled a little bit. But then, you know, you look at guys like Murrow, who stood up and put every fucking thing they had on the line to make sure they told the truth. And the truth that guys like Breslin put out was written for, by, and about people that were affected by these events in a way that nobody does anymore. The closest, honest to God, the closest equivalent I can come to it is Headline News, the Robin Meads morning show, right? Where they mm-hmm. do the salute right. to the troops. Where family members of people in the military that are serving in the military can call and leave a message and send a couple of pictures and say nice things about their service member. What the fuck else is there? Where else can you find something, you know, like the man who dug JFK's grave? You know, like somebody who so beautifully and poetically, you know, put the metaphor of the blood on the hands of the leaders of the world that not only in let us do what we did, but encouraged the doing of it. Because make no mistake, we built a coalition. Nobody had to come with us. So fuck a bunch of Tony Blair. Asshole.
We did.
forever.
Yeah.
Forever. Yeah. I mean, every single time I see Tony Blair, who destroyed the Labor Party more? Tony Blair. And then just walked away. To me. I mean, that's political. That's a whole other matter. But these people are responsible and complicit because some of these people were capable of doing the job that they were in, Jeff. Other people had no business being in there. Bush, Trump, Pence, you know, Ryan, whoever. I mean, we're about to see what's going to happen tomorrow because you have people who have cravenly decided to carry the water for corporations, their donors, just because a black guy got one of the greatest flawed healthcare plans through Congress. They want to not only gut it, they want to punish people. They want to hurt people. They want to see people die.
You know, not for nothing, and I should probably save this for our What Did We Learn Today, Tom, segment. But
indeed.
There is, when you follow the narrative of the right on poverty, take away all the other specifics of poverty, but poverty in and of itself. You go down to, was it fucking Napolitano on Fox or some other fat-headed white-looking guy that complained that poor people in America have refrigerators?
Oh, that's right.
And what they want, what they are desperate to see, is bread lines and grain trucks in our community parks and having the poor folk line up, act properly humble to their better moneyed betters, to be destitute, to live in tent cities. These are guys that, not for nothing, look at the tent cities in DC after World War I and go, well, that's where poor people should go. Why should they be in a house if they can't afford it? Why should they have refrigerators? It's Jason Chaffetz, Republican of Utah. So sorry, not my fault.
There you go.
Saying, hey, if you want health care, don't get an iPhone. Like the monthly bump to your bill for an iPhone could possibly cover anything other than slightly stronger, not quite over-the-counter 800 milligram ibuprofen after your fucking copays and before you hit your fucking deductible. That's the cost of a monthly cost on a two-year contract for a fucking iPhone is around $18. I can't get healthcare for $18. I can't buy enough fucking aspirin for $18 a month. But some little peckerhead who made his fucking bones in multi-level marketing and pyramid schemes selling shitty fucking lotions to gullible Mormon women.
Holy shit. Are you saying Amway? Chaffetz was an Amway?
No, he was New Skin.
Amway guy?
He was New Skin.
New Skin.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
They're lotion merchants. And, you know, and then he made his way into the governor's mansion. And got his ass canned from there by double booking appointments, having the governor go to one, and then he would show up as the governor's representative at the other until he got caught and got canned. And in the Republican Party, man, you fail the fuck up. And this is part of his diabolical genius. When that fucker got elected to Congress, he had people that were helping with his campaign then turn around and run for municipal office, both, you know, mayors and city councils in the cities in his district, so that when he stopped bringing home pork, nobody would bitch. Not so much to stop pork, but to stop so he could message on it and have nobody complain. Now, the problem with that is that the reason that the cities fucking complain when this stuff disappears is because people are getting hurt. And all he did was just silence their voices, put a muzzle on anybody who thought anything that he did was wrong. He really is a slightly less histrionic version of Trump in a slightly different skin tone and with currently less money. But he worked ahead of time to cut off all complaint and criticism to what he did to hurt the people that keep fucking voting for him. Gerrymandering. So,
amazing.
Yeah, Jason Chaffetz.
Fucking amazing. And the lesson that we're going to learn is words matter, ladies and gentlemen. Intent matters. Follow through matters.
It does.
Integrity. Yes, integrity, freedom, and liberties.
All right. Well, let's tie a knot in this fallopian tube and then come back and talk about what we've learned today. Is that good?
Let's do it.
Awesome.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo.
We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day.
People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything.
I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
What do you miss when you miss The Left Show?
Huckabee, being a former pastor,
yeah,
and the biggest mouthpiece for the Christian right, has proven himself time and again to not be a Christian because he believes that Levitical law is absolute and was never removed by Christ.
Right.
So he's a rabbi,
yeah,
and therefore not Christian.
Yeah, yes. He's Rabbi Huckabee.
Why not? Then he gets to eat better deli food.
Oh. Haven't the Jews been through enough?
Yeah.
That was a good point. Good point.
I am pretty sure.
I know.
We got a little bit to go, but I am pretty sure Taylor just won the show.
Fresh episodes every Monday on iTunes, Stitcher, and theleftshow.com.
It's Roast with Jeff and Tom. Now, here are your Roast Masters.
All right, so I went first at the beginning, so you have to go first for lessons learned and other pontification.
Okay, lessons learned.
All right.
Lessons learned, words matter. What worked with Breslin was the fact that he thought with his feet. And I think that if you're a writer and you're very, very serious about your craft, I think that you'll take a different type of process than you will somebody like Chris Cizilla or some other craven, really bad writer. Right now, there's an example of the yin and yang right there, Jeff. You?
All right. You can't really judge on what someone says in one particular moment as to whether or not that thing will come true. There are promises made and promises broken throughout history by people with good intentions and bad. What we saw with Trump and his candidacy, and then Trump and his transition, and now Trump as president of the United fucking States of America.
Jesus.
Is a man that will say anything in the moment to divert the heavy or the heat of that particular moment. I don't know if you caught the CNN story today as we record, yesterday as we drop, where he was called out. Are you so full of shit? Why do you lie? What is the deal? And amidst lots of excuses and, hey, I'm just a prophet, that whole Sweden thing. Well, 3 days later, they had a kerfuffle, right? His line was, I'm the president and you're not.
Yeah.
Now, historically, since that seems to be what I'm doing so far, who else said such a thing? What was that? Oh, it was Nixon talking to Frost. When the president does a thing.
Oh, just because the president does it makes it legal.
Does not mean it's illegal.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's where we're at. Not only are we back to Nixon, Trump lacks the style, the smoothness, and the sophistication of Richard fucking Nixon.
That's a low bar.
It is. I mean, and look, one of the things I really, really like about certain kinds of news is the historical context of a thing. In specific, unlike the way I'm doing it, which is, let me show you some examples of how this means something. because this is just opinion. I'm just tying loose ends together. Whereas you go to like The Daily Show still with Trevor Noah, and they do the here's what he said, here's when he said it, and then here's what he said now, and here's what he's doing now. And they do that with Trump. Well, if you go back and you look at excerpts from The Art of the Deal, he calls it and points at what he's going to do. And that is, you can get anything done by lying, and you should lie as often as you want and as much as you possibly can. However, you got to tie that deal up before you get caught, because sooner or later you run out of bullshit and then people know what's going on.
Eventually people come around.
Yeah. And they figure it out. And I think that's where we're at, is the man will say fucking anything. Look, I think Ted Cruz's dad is, without a doubt, probably a very dangerous human being. But mm-hmm. I do that because he believes in a magical sky monkey that gets mad at us for masturbation. And when you consider the size and the scope of all of creation, especially, you know, all of that that's not Earth, I think the giant sky monkey, who, if he exists, which I know he doesn't, could give a shit as to whether or not I'm polishing my knob. And if he is made of love, then me jerking off as opposed to, I don't know, committing a spree killing or jumping that up to, you know, committing a genocide, I'm pretty sure I'm okay. I get to the, I die and I go to the pearly gates and they're like, wow, boy.
you know, wanking.
Were you the president of the Onan fan club? And it's like, fuck yeah, I was. Did I murder? No. Did I rape? No. What do you say we call it a wash? Because, you know. All I did was spend a minute and a half taking care of my prostate health as often as every day as I could. I'm just saying, if that wasn't the most awesome fucking scientific study ever,
that
turns
is awesome.
Out, jerking off, boys, is good for the prostate health.
I had such guilt. Oh, yeah. God.
Mine
was
has to be made of
I was
platinum.
Like, it took a while for me to realize, like, am I gay? Am I gay? I'm touching myself. Good God, am I gay? It took so much therapy.
Really? It didn't take just seeing boobs once?
Well, when you're in a... I got told, you know, when your kind of upbringing is a little bit like a cult. And when you're in a Roman Catholic family of like not 11... That includes mom and dad. Things tend to get regimented and really fucking weird.
Right.
So it took a while for me to come to my senses.
Hang on. Here's my theory on anti-Catholic masturbation. Catholic in specific, because they were the biggest church in the world for a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was because you were not, these families were so goddamn big.
Yeah.
And their houses were so goddamn small. That don't jerk off was more of a, you're tying up the bathroom and there's 14 other of your siblings that need to get in there. Because if it wasn't that, then it was the wife of a parish priest that was allowed to marry, that was sick to shit of their teenaged boy or boys. You know, what did they have for socks before we had socks?
Oh, geez, I don't know.
Right.
Maybe tights. Towels, large
sure.
towel.
Whatever.
Whatever.
They were leaving, you know, the dead baby batter, you know, of the Onan's warning all over everything. And she just got sick of picking it up. It's too much that I already have to do with whatever it is your father does for 11 seconds every third fortnight. Not cleaning up yours, sticky messes. Now, I know that I'm wrong, but it, you know, I like the idea. Look, when you break down Mormons, you know, and we have the prohibition, we have the word of wisdom, you know, no tobacco. And when that was written, more people were chewing and spitting than they were smoking, you know, no hot drinks.
That's right.
No. And these things and the other. And all that I could put that down to was it's like Joseph Smith's first wife. What a punished woman. That his first wife got sick of having to make fucking coffee for these assholes that kept coming over to the house and spitting chaw all over the floor. And instead of saying, dude, you guys are pissing off my wife, he's like, the Lord has revealed unto me this day the following list of shit you can't do at my house. And the guys are like, oh, the Lord. I get it. Wink, wink. And now it's turned into a thing where it's not even a rule as a Mormon to not drink coffee or smoke cigarettes or any of that. It is really? A very, well, do as I say, not as I do, you know, practice over preaching. Mm-hmm. And that is, yeah, it is a suggestion. The word of wisdom is suggestions from the Lord and the church, whatever, to this is how you live a healthier life. One of those rules being, hey, don't eat red meat every day. Because you got to know that Mary Smith was sick to fuck of having to feed these fuckers, you know, beef pot pie every goddamn day. And she's like, can't they eat some fucking chicken? And yeah, but if you go down, the list of the Mormon's word of wisdom, you can find, and I didn't realize this until I got married, you can find okay. a wifely tantrum attached to nearly every one of them. So you can make a tea for your fucking friends.
Who said he didn't listen to his wife?
And then, you know, but he's like, okay, I'm going to do all that. But someday I'm going to come to you with an idea and you're just going to have to accept it. And she's like, fine, whatever. And then several weeks later, he's like, hi, these two 13-year-old girls are our new wives. So be careful, ladies. I think women have learned since then. I don't get concessions.
Where have we been since then? God. So that's it. That's roast.
So what did we learn? We learned that Joseph Smith's wife was probably a little put out. That's what I learned today.
Yeah? Oh, my God.
Awesome. Well, thanks, buddy. That's another one.
That's great. And we're good.
We're good.
The word is about there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating. People shout, a new style is growing, but it don't know if it's coming.